This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
She's an Aaronite. She was from a descendant of Aaron. They're the temple keepers. And that's why when Zechariah and Elizabeth wanted to give her to the temple, when she was born a daughter, they couldn't do it because the daughters don't serve the temple, but the Aaronites serve the temple. So, it's one of the ways that Arabs speak. When somebody's a descendant of somebody, they call them by that name to remind them of that, because they were saying, why are you doing this? Right? So this is something, it's just a clarification that the Christians of Najran wanted from the Prophet, and he explained it to them. There are many things that Christians wonder about Islam that need explaining, and they should get their explanations. But not, then I'll take a job in the state. What is that? Shakespeare said, blood is no argument. Just because you blinded somebody to death doesn't mean you win the argument, irrespective of what George Bush did in Iraq or not. It's not winning an argument. You know, to go bomb a country and who's stronger? No, who's right and who's wrong? That's the question, and that's for people with intellects to look and decide. Blood is no argument. Just because you're powerful, we give power to whom we please. It changes around. Now we're on top. Maybe the Chinese will be on top. Really? And then people are going to say, Rahim ala Amerika. So who knows where it's all going? Then you have people in the Quran that are muhalifun. Imam Zayd mentioned that verse, and I just want to look at a couple just to show you, because there's only a few verses that are always pulled out to attack the Muslims. The same verses. There was a recent study done where a Christian in the United States compared the Bible and the Quran in terms of violent verses, and he argued that the Bible, to be fair, was so much more violent than the Quran. I mean, this is in Christianity, people, if you look at the Bible has verses in the Old Testament, which Jewish people still believe in, by the way. And we have Jewish settlers that take those verses very seriously, that believe you can just kill people with impunity. Baruch Goldstein was a religious Jew, graduated from a yeshiva in New York. He was a physician, an educated man. When he went into the masjid in Al-Khalil and shot and killed 26 Palestinians while they were worshipping, he thought he was getting close to God. He was using the Torah as a basis for what he was doing. Because he thought he was purifying Iman al-Mushrikun al-Najis. He was purifying that place. We have a Jewish rabbinical student that killed Rabin and shot him, believing he was acting in accordance with the Torah. We have Christians in the United States of America that kill doctors performing legal abortions by the secular laws of the United States, and America is a secular country. If you don't like it, leave. I'm against abortion, but the law of the land says that it is legal. They have shot and killed abortionists in the United States. Doctors. These are Christian terrorists. They bombed abortion clinics and killed them. But they're not described as Christian terrorists. Even a man acting out of a political ideology got into an airplane and drove it into a federal building recently. And they asked, is this a terrorist act? No, it's a lone nut. Is the idea, is a problem. How can you talk if you don't have the same definitions? I don't know of any Omani that has committed a terrorist act. In fact, if you look at the history of Long Island, with the exception of the slave trade in East Africa, which I haven't studied enough to know what was going on, but with that exception, which was a norm at the time, and it's hard to judge previous peoples on modern sensibilities. But Oman has been a peaceful country. It hasn't attacked anybody. And I see Western people here, they seem very comfortable. They're not afraid. They've been here a long time. There's some Western people in this room, right, Sebastian? Do you feel afraid? No? Do you feel safer than you would in Berlin at 2 in the morning when the bars are just closing? Really? I think Westerners are safer here than Muslims in many European countries now. That's a fact. So this idea somehow that Muslims are these evil people that are doing evil, dastardly things, we have crackpots. We've also got 1.3 billion followers. Just statistically, you're going to have nutcases that are higher than other groups. I mean, it's just simple logic. So if you look at the Muhammad book, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, and this is a very interesting verse in the Quran to me, which is in Surah Al-Baqarah, where it says, وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ. Fight those who fight you. قَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ. Fight those who fight you. The Prophet was given permission. That permission was granted in Surah Al-Hajj. Permission was granted to those who have been fought to now defend themselves. That was in Mecca when they had a polity, a state. Because they were oppressed. Right? So if you look at this verse, it says, fight those who fight you. What I tell you, there's the shot. Don't be aggressors. Just like they've oppressed on you, don't do what they've done. What I tell you, inna Allah yahbiru mu'tadin. Allah does not love those who are aggressive. حب الله إذا تعلق بشيء الحب من صفات الله سبحانه وتعالى إرادة أبدية. Allah does not love oppressors or aggressors. لا تعلم إن الله يحب المعتدين واقتلوهم حيث ثقفتموهم وأخرجوهم من حيث أخرجوكم. Kill them where you find them. Once you start fighting, the goal of fighting is to kill. Qatala is from fa'ala is muhawala. So qatala is an attempt to kill. Once you start fighting, kill them. And it actually says in Dharb al-Riqab, and the Professor would say the most humane way of killing somebody on a battlefield is to strike them back. So it's actually rahmah. That's the idea behind that verse. And then it says, and take them out just as they drove you out, when fitna to ashadu min al-qatli. Persecution is worse than killing. To persecute people for no reason other than their belief or whatever reason, because they're weak and you want their natural resources, all those things, to fight and defend and kill people that are trying to do that to you is actually less than what they're doing. Whatever the qatiluhum in the masjid al-haram, but respect the sacred. Respect the sacred. Don't fight them in hatta yuqatilukum fi, until they fight you there. فَإِنْقَاتِلُوكُمْ فَاقْتُلُوهُمْ. And if they fight you, then you have permission to defend yourself and kill them. كَذَلِكَ جَزَاءُ الْكَافِرِينَ. And this is the reward of people that are against the truth and fight the truth and oppose the truth. Now what it says. But if they stop oppressing you, God is forgiving and merciful. If they're not going to fight you and oppress you, then there's no reason for you to use violence against them. It's right there in the Quran. وَقَاتِلُهُمْ. And then again, وَقَاتِلُهُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةٌ. Fight them until there's no persecution. Fight them until there's no persecution. وَيَكُونَ الدِّينُ لِلَّهِ. And religion can be for the sake of God without having to worry about being punished for what you're doing. And then it says, فَإِنْ تَهُوا فَلَا أَلْمَانِ إِلَّا أَلْمَانِ. But if they stop, don't be aggressive against them. Because you should only aggress against oppressors. You should only fight against oppressors. I mean, look at that. فمن اعتدى عليكم فاعتدوا عليه بمثل ما اعتدى. If they fight you, then you have permission to fight them. But don't transgress. لا يجرمنكم شنآن قوم على أن تعدلوا. اعدلوا هو أقرب للتقوى. Don't let the hatred of these people. You know what a shan'an is? The difference between shan'an and both in the Arabic language is a major difference. إن الشان هو الأفضل. Your shan is the one who's cut off. Shan'an is a hatred that will not acknowledge the virtues of their object of hatred. So even though people are not even acknowledging anything good in you, be just with them. Don't let that hatred that they're showing you get into your hearts to where you begin to act unjustly. Because God is with the people of taqwa. Now, just look, I want you to look at this one other verse. Here. In Surah At-Tawbah. This is the other one that they always pull out. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that when the months of Quran end, فَقْتُلُوا الْمُشْرِكِينَ حَيْثُ وَجِدْتُمُوهُمْ وَخُوبُهُمْ وَحْصُرُوهُمْ وَقْعُدُوا لَهُمْ كُلَّ مَرْصَدٍ. That when the end of the months come, you have this permission to go and kill them. Where do you find them? This verse was because they broke their treaty and were treacherous, and they killed some of the believers that were unarmed. And the Prophet was given permission. But look what it says. So that there's the heart. فَإِنْ تَابُوا وَأَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ فَخَلُّوا سَبِيلَهُمْ. But if they repent, if they pray, if they then leave them alone. But then it says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. Allah is merciful, forgiving. وَإِنْ أَحَدٌ مِنَ الْمُشْرِكِينَ اسْتَجَارَ. And if one of the mushrikeen استجار فأجره. If one of them asks for safety, in other words, if you're fighting and he says, ajabni, this is what the Arabs used to do, ajabni, then you say, you put your sword down, because the Arabs will leave with their word. So it says, even if you're fighting them and he asks you to for aman, give him aman. The mushrik, not somebody who's become Muslim, حَتَّى يَسْمَعَ كَلَامُ اللَّهِ, in order that he might hear the speech of God. ثُمَّ أَبْلِدْهُ مَأْمَنُهُ. And if he doesn't become Muslim, don't kill him. Take him to a safe place and then leave him. Why don't people read what comes after? It's so clear. Read the Quran and look at the mercy in the book of Allah. All these ayahs that can be interpreted harshly are always followed up by compassion. إِنَّ اللَّهَ مَعَ الْمُحْسِنِينَ. اتَّقُوا اللَّهَ. Have taqwa of Allah. لَا تَعْتَدُوا. Don't be aggressive. Throughout the Quran we find it. Now just in closing, if you look at the practice of early Muslims with other religions, we have churches all over the Muslim world. Churches, Coptic churches in Egypt. We have synagogues in Tunisia and in Morocco and in Yemen. We have Hindu temples in India. Wherever the Muslims ruled, the religions that were previous there were kept intact. Those who became Muslim, and those who stayed outside were protected, and their houses of worship were protected, with rare exception. To this day, Tamim al-Dali's family, to this day, the Miftah of the Church of the Sepulchre in Jerusalem is held by a Muslim and opens the Christian Church, one of the most sacred Christian churches in the history of Christendom. It's opened by a Muslim because Omar gave him the key, and that key has stayed with the Muslims until the end of time. The Muslims, when they arrived in Jerusalem, do you know what they found on Mount Zion, which is where the temple is? It was being used as a garbage dump by the Christians. The Christians prohibited Jews from coming into Jerusalem to worship. They were not allowed to come into Jerusalem. This is history. I'm not making this up. This is history. You can Google it and it's all on there. For anybody who wants to see this, when Allah Almighty got there, one of the first things they did was clean the Temple Mount because it's a sacred place. And then they built the extraordinary Dome of the Rock. And the Masjid of Aqsa was restored. And to this day, Muslims have worshipped on there, respecting the Jews. it is well known in Orthodox Judaism, it is impermissible for a Jew to set his foot on the Temple Mount. And I'm not making this up. This is Jewish halacha law. What Ariel Sharon did when he went up on the Temple Mount was against rabbinical law. And the rabbis of Jerusalem, the official state religion of Jerusalem, is Orthodox Judaism. Not Reform, not conservative, it is Orthodox Judaism. He was acting as an unfaithful, impious Jew when he set foot on the Temple Mount, because it is illegal for Jews to set foot on the Temple Mount until it's purified with the red heifer ashes and the Messiah identifies where the holiest of holies is. And this is well known in the Jewish tradition. So the fact that the Muslims are there and they're not going against Jewish law by being on them, they're not. The Muslims honor these places. If you look at the Hagia Sophia was turned into a masjid, that's true. And the Muslims have rules about coming into a country, Anglican, or with Slovak, things like that. There's no doubt that the Hagia Sophia was taken by the Muslims, turned into a masjid, and the Orthodox Christians lost their spot. And I come out of an Orthodox family. My grandfather was Orthodox, so that was actually a sacred spot to, and still is, to the people in my family that are from that tradition. But the modern Turks have, it's no longer a masjid, it's a museum. One of the things that you'll note about that, instead of defacing the icons, they just whitewashed and painted over them. The original icons are still there today. You can go into the Hagia Sophia and see the original icons. The Muslims did not scrape them down or trim them, they just whitewashed them and left them there out of respect for that extraordinary artwork that was done. They could have easily destroyed those, but they didn't. The Ottomans were extremely sensitive to other faiths. So, if you look at the Muslim pre-modern historical record of other religions, in my estimation, it's unparalleled. The Mongols, the Mongols, what we call the Mahul, the Mongolian horde, when it came down, the Mongolians were actually to be fair to them. They were very similar to the Americans. If you went against them, they bombed the hell out of you. But if you went along with them, they were actually reasonably good occupiers. And they let you kind of do what you wanted to do. So the Mongols, when they went into the Muslim lands, they actually did, once they subdued the population quite viciously, if you resisted them. If you didn't, they were actually reasonable. But if you resisted them, and well, a lot of Muslims don't know this, but the real reason for the Mongol invasion was because one of the stupid Muslim rulers actually killed Mongolian ambassadors in Central Asia. And the Prophet prohibited ever killing, he didn't even kill the ambassadors of Musaylim and Kadat. And he told them, Ar-Rusul la yuqtalun, wa law la qataltukum. But they killed these Mongolians, and that's when the horde came down. You know, you break, you know, يَحْكَرَ الَّذِينَ يُخَارِبُونَ عَنْ أَمْرِهِ beware to go against the Prophet's teaching, or you will be afflicted with great calamities. The Prophet honored people. The Prophet said, مَنْ أَذَى ذِيًّا فَأَنَا خَصْمُهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. Whoever harms a living, a person who's in a protected status in the Muslim world, if they harm them, I am an advocate for him against that Muslim on the Yawm al-Qiyamah. That's the justice of our religion. The Prophet will argue against. We know Shuraykh al-Babi, when the Jew and Imam Ali, who was the caliph at the time, got into an argument and they went to Shuraykh al-Babi. And Shuraykh, Allah al Yahudi, because the only witness that Ali had was his son and there was a conflict of interest. And so he rejected, this is in our books. We know that when Qutaybah entered into Central Asia and found the Buddhists, he not only protected one of the greatest Buddhist temples in all of Buddhist history, which was in Balkh, Afghanistan. He protected it. They remained Buddhists there for the next 300 years. In fact, the head of that monastery became Muslim at Qutaybah's hand. When Hussein's revolt happened, and it they had to withdraw from Central Asia to come down for the revolt that was happening in Iraq. The Turkish Shahis and the Tibetan Buddhists allied, they were all Buddhists, and they drove the Muslims out of Afghanistan. It was reconquered again. You know what they did, the Buddhists? You know what they did to that Abbasid? They cut off his head. This is history. Read Arnold's book, The Preaching of Islam, how Islam treated other religions. Now, I will say, because I'm a fair person, and I'm not a tribal, I'm not embedded in Islam. You know, I'm a Muslim, but I'm not embedded in Islam. There's Muslims that are embedded in Islam. My tribe, or the highway. Right? In the Allah to the way, if my tribe goes astray, I go astray with them. There's some people that have that mentality. Mm-hmm. Not for me. The Muslims have a checkered past. There is persecution in our history, not only of Muslims, and the Ibadi people know this very well. There's persecution in our history, there's persecution of Christians in our history, there's persecution of Hindus in our history, and there's persecution of Jews and Buddhists. But, I would argue, there is no textual evidence that fuqaha in the history of Islam have ever argued for that. They always recognize it as a wrong and a breach of Islamic law. We do not have justification for persecution. People talk about the crusade thing started because this insane Hagi Ben Bilal burnt down the church. The historians in the Christian world never illustrate the fact that it was rebuilt by his successor. And he made an official apology to Christians for the insane act of that volume. Our ulama had said early on that Allah will give victory to a just non-Muslim people over an unjust Muslim people. Because we're people of justice. And if we don't live by just rules that God has given us, God will send people who are more just than we are, and He will give them victory over us. Sayyidina Omar said that. In the Sawayat al-Ma'asi, Ghadabuna bil-Udda wal-Idda. If we're equal, he said it to Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, when he was going, if we're equal in disobedience, they'll always win. This is the justice of Islam. It's a beautiful religion. Its history is an extraordinary history of tolerance. There are no mosques in Europe where the Christians took over. You go look at the places where the Christians took over. There aren't mosques there anymore. Pultola is not there. It's a museum with a church in the middle of it. But it was never restored as a masjid. The Pope said, give us back Hagia Sophia and we'll give you back Pultola. You know? But that's one example. There's no masjids in Granada anymore. They were all turned into churches. Wherever Muslims went, they protected the people. That's why Orthodox Christians, Armenian Christians, have worshipped in the Middle East for centuries. The Coptic Church, there's 8 million Coptic Christians in Egypt to this day. Unfortunately, because of the Israeli problem, the Jews were chased out of some of the Arab countries. Part of that, even one Jewish man, a fair Jewish man in London, Sidney Mansour, who's a very prominent Jewish, Moroccan Jewish man, he told me that the Israelis were involved in a lot of these things. They actually wanted the Arabs to migrate. A lot of the Arab Jews did not want to leave to go to Israel because they've been living for centuries there. They were in their homes. But unfortunately, because of this situation, Muslims have fallen victim, I think, to a type of European anti-Semitism that was not traditional to the Jewish world. It really wasn't. There's political reasons for it, and it's a problem. And I really hope that the Muslims will stop making all these curses on the minbars. Allahumma kina shabbat. You know, but yithin al-dadahum, wa'arun nisa'ahum, wa'shabbatahum, wa'abadidum, but those things, really, it's just, it's not working. Let Allahumma ahdina. Let's try a different strategy. Jazakallah khairan. Thank you.
Politics, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Inna al-Qur'an wa sultan sayaftariqani, faduru haythu dar al-Qur'an." The Qur'an and politics are going to part ways soon. He said that it would last 30 years, and his prediction was absolutely accurate. The Khulafa al-Rashidin ended, and the political Islam as ala minhaj al-Nubuwwah, based on prophetic truth, changed. And then politics became kings fighting, and then Jababira. So you're lucky to have an enlightened ruler. That can shed yuhfad wa la yuqas alayh. It's a principle in balagha that people that in grammar, if something breaks the rule, you keep it in mind, but you don't base the rule on it. So good rulers are the exception; they're not the rule. So you're very fortunate to have the exception that illustrates the rule in this country. Now, the modern Muslim world was afflicted 100 years ago with colonization. The Muslim response to colonization was what went wrong. Two major responses occurred. One, we've been defeated because of technology. That's the logistical response. So suddenly all the Muslims had to start learning engineering. And now we've got a billion engineers and no historians, no literary scholars, no, I mean, it's just amazing. Because of the belief that the Europeans got their power through technology. The other response was the problem was too much spirituality. And so there was a movement against the devotional aspects of Islam and a focus on political Islam. This became very prominent in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and then it really comes to a head in the 60s. And then you see the Marxists in the Muslim world begin to adapt Islamist ideology. And that's why you see now a hybrid that's closer to Marxism than it is to Islam, but it uses all of the slogans of Islam. But it's far closer to Marxism, and one of the basic principles of Marxism is the end justifies the means, and so there's no longer rules of engagement, there's no longer adherence to ethics and morality in war, anything goes. Which is very different from the early Muslims. So, I would say personally, in the Muslim world, we want to see Muslims who, when they're in a majority of their country, they want to see a ruler who's a pious ruler, like the one that you have here. There's no indication that he's other than a pious man that has built in mosques like this that are extraordinary. And you see this in some of the other Muslim countries. There are other Muslim countries where the rulers are actually opposed to Islam and make it quite difficult for people to practice their faith. So that, that's my basic view on it. I don't think the problem in the Muslim world is more a problem of disparity of wealth. And that's why in countries like Oman, where you don't have the types of disparities of wealth that you see in a country like Pakistan or a country like Egypt, where there's such a gap between the rich and the poor. One of the things that we're very happy to see is how normal the culture is here. It's really, me, Imam Zayd and I both have commented on that. You don't see these jalopies next to these $200,000 Lamborghinis. It's a more balanced culture, and that's healthy for people. The single most powerful ethical force in the world is middle class prosperity. It's not religion. The single most powerful ethical force in the world is middle class prosperity. When people have enough and they're living reasonable lives, they tend to not be corrupt people. Sexual morality is very much the realm of religion. Without religion, America's a good example and Europe's a good example of what can happen in terms of sexual morality. But in terms of social morality, economics, trading, buying and selling, when you have a reasonably stable economic system, the corruption is far less. This is why the least corrupt countries in the world are the northern European countries, hands down. The most corrupt countries in the world, unfortunately, almost every year, Pakistan gets number one, number two, and Nigeria gets number one. But I was told by a close Pakistani friend of mine, the Pakistanis bribed the Nigerians to take number one.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Before we move to the written
questions. Imam Zayd might want to add to that because he's actually the political scientist.
Yes?
That's one thing I always respected about the
he's being accused of being the Lord, standing in the nation of Islam, third generation of the invented by grace, the love, the teachings, and the knowledge. And I thank you for all the teachings. I've written so much, I don't know. But anyways, I love the respect for others. Of course, in every religion, every place you go, there's bad seeds. But you represent goodness, and I want to steal that from you.
Thank you.
My question is, you said something about if they attack you, attack back. But also, you said something about if you come in an argument, stand in silence. When do you know when to attack, and when do you know when to stand back? We can't be doormats.
In terms of an argument or discussion or debate, at the point where you're so invested in your point that the truth doesn't matter, it's time to cease that argument. And in terms of any sort of military conflict, at the point where you're more invested in winning as opposed to preserving your principles, even if to preserve your principles you might lose, it's time to stop that. These are all Islamic principles. Allah mentions, Almighty God mentions, in the Quran, وَمَنْ نَصْرِدَ مِنْ عَزِيزَ الْحَكِيمِ, that victory comes from God. And so you can't win by violating your principles. Victory only comes from God. In fact, if you violate your principles, there's a greater likelihood that you're going to lose. So at the point, so as the Sheikh comes to mention another version when he was talking about not transgressing. If they stop, you stop. So God also mentions in the Quran, when in general, this is even in a conflict, if the people opposing you incline towards peace and make an offer for peace, then you accept that. And don't even think they're doing this because they want to regroup. Or they're doing this so that we'll lose our momentum. No. Trust in God that it's not some sort of conspiracy or some scheme. But to what kind of law? So these are all Quranic principles. And I would say that soon you stop and cease.
I'll just want to add one thing to that. The Prophet ﷺ was commanded in the Quran to dialogue in a certain way. بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنْ اِبْتَعَ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنْ, that respond in a more beautiful way than what's coming to you. One of the beautiful things that he was told to say was, وَإِنَّا أَوْ إِيَّاكُمْ لَعَلَى هُدًى أَوْ فِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ, either I'm rightly guided or you're wrong rightly guided. Let's talk. One of us is right, one of us is wrong. Let's talk. And then it says, he says, لَا تُسْأَلُونَ عَمَّا أَجْرَمْنَا وَلَا نُسْأَلُوا عَمَّا تَعْمَلُونَ. He says, you won't be asked about our crimes, our wrong, even though حَشَاهُ صلى الله عليه وسلم, he never did anything wrong. But he uses that as a way of speaking so the person feels comfortable with him. He says, you won't be asked about what I've done wrong. And then he says, and I won't be asked about what you do. He doesn't say ma tujrimun. He says ma ta'malun. I won't be asked about what you do. And so part of an important thing is in discussing is recognizing that people have different perspectives. And the Quran, if you look at the kafirun in the Quran, most human beings are just human beings. The kafir in the Quran has fakhr, has ikhtiyal, he's got arrogance, he's pride, he's got istikbar, he's got istihza, he mocks and makes fun of. These are the attributes. But many, many people outside of Islam have beautiful akhlaq. And the Prophet praised akhlaq. Look what he did with Hatim al-Jud, Hatim al-Ta'i. There's people from Bani Ta'i in this country. Hatim al-Ta'i was one of the great Arab chivalrous people. He was so generous. There's a famous story of a man who wanted to buy a horse from him, and he came because it was a famous horse. He came and Hatim had nothing to feed him. And the Arabs used to eat horses when they were, and so he took this incredible horse and he slaughtered it and he fed them. And Arabs never asked what they wanted. You take 3 days, then you ask the question. Some Western businessmen learn that after a while, you know. But he waited 3 days, and then he said, "What have you come for?" And he said, "I want to buy your horse." He said, "We've been eating it the last 3 days." But Hatim al-Ta'i, his daughter, when she was taken prisoner in a battle that happened, the Prophet used to walk by and she would try to get his attention. On the third day she got his attention and he said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm the daughter of Hatim al-Ta'i." And he said, "Let her go. فَإِنَّ أَبَاهَا كَنْ يُحِبُّ مَكَارَمَ الْأَخْلَاقِ." He said, "Free her because her father loved noble character." So he honored a non-Muslim because of the noble character of her non-Muslim father. وَكَانَ أَبُوهُمَا صَالِحًا. And it's amazing testimony to recognition of the good in others. And that's why the shan'an is when you don't like somebody and you won't even recognize the good in them. Your hatred is so, it's so foul that you can't even see the good in your enemy. And noble people always recognize the good in their enemies. Always. It's ignoble people that don't recognize the good of their enemies. And so arguing is generally, Imam Malik used to say, لَيْسَ الْجِدَارُ مِنَ الدِّينِ فِي شَيْءٍ. Argumentation is not part of this religion. Discussion is what's called حِوَار. And debate in a good way, in a beautiful way. Not trying to beat the other person. Imam Shafi'i, one of our great scholars, said something so beautiful. He said, "I never debated anyone except that I asked God that He would give him the truth, that I could submit to it." Because he preferred to humble himself. And that it's not showing off or trying to beat somebody, not we showed them. It's like you have these debates between Muslims and Christians, and the Muslims come out saying we showed them, and the Christians go out saying we showed them. It's like football matches. When the Ainawis come here, do you guys play Al-Ain? Because I'm Ainawi, and forgive me. I went to school in Al-Ain. I can't leave my football team. But when they come to Oman, if they beat Oman, then nobody becomes supporters of Al-Ain's football team in Oman. They just say, "We'll get them next time." Right? Same in these debates. It's the same thing because the spirit of truth is not in the debates. It's the spirit of ghalaba. We want to beat them. We want to show them how much better we are than them. That's not the methodology of the Prophet ﷺ or the Qur'an. It's humility. The Prophet said, "Umirtu an atawadha'a hatta la yafkhara ahadun ala ahad." I was told to be humble until no one would show arrogance to another person. That's our Prophet ﷺ.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Can you give an opportunity to my hand? Please.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank the people of Oman since I've been here 7 months and I've been every time I've met Oman people, they've been very kind and very hospitable in any situation. So that's a thank you to all of you basically and to your lovely culture. Having said that, I want to add my gratitude to being able to listen here tonight to the great speakers. Thank you very much. It's very enlightening and very informative. I have two questions. I don't know if that's possible. They're very diverse. First question is, there are accounts of Muslim people who are converting to Christianity, for instance, or either to Judaism, and from what I've understood and also kind of experienced close by, is that these people, if they grew up like in their Muslim family, that they're kind of rejected
And I was wondering how you would comment on that, because you've been saying like,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah, no, it's a good question. Mm-hmm.
So that's basically my first question.
Okay.
Do you want to comment on that first?
No, go ahead. What's the second one?
And the second question is,
I'm hoping it's easier than the first one.
Very good. My second question is, I'm from one of the North European countries that you mentioned, from Holland, and we have a big, what I would call it, a problem, and his name is Geert Wilders. I don't know if you
right, sure, yeah, we know.
Yes, mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. Any of you have heard of him, but he is a politician who has been very strong in creating a polarized situation
right.
between basically Dutch people and
Muslims.
Yeah. I very oppose his political party and his political views. And my question is, how would you comment on that situation, and how would you advise commoners, regular people, to establish a situation of mutual respect, and how to kind of counter-react on these political
right.
Situations?
Okay. Do you want to?
The second
one? Go ahead. I'll do the first one.
I think people of all stripes have to realize the commonality that they share. So I'm sure in Holland, like most countries, the common Muslim who's just there trying to make a better life for himself or herself, raise their family, go to work every day, just basically be left alone. That's the attitude of the common Hollander. So there's a common decency when they see each other. There's no animosity. And then you have some people who have agendas where either they see in their vested interest to create this kind of animosity because it advances their agenda. And they might be Muslims, they might be from the original inhabitants of a European land. So I think that the best way forward is for the common people to allow their values and to allow their sensibilities and sensitivities to be the basis of their politics and not someone else's agenda. So not to allow themselves to become susceptible to someone else's agenda. And from a Muslim perspective, I think it's very important for Muslims to understand the rights and responsibilities they have if they're a guest who's been invited into a non-Muslim land. That they have a fundamental right to respect the laws of that land. And to understand the great trust, even going back to the very first question that we as Muslims hold. So, in terms of rulers have a great trust to give everything to serve, to uplift, to protect their people. Ordinary Muslims have a great trust when they're in a society, even in this society, where there are a lot of non-Muslims passing through. Because what they say or do might become the thing that either pushes that person away from Islam, as the first questioner mentioned, when they ordinarily would be very receptive, or makes that person who might not be religiously motivated, so they're not looking for a particular religion, but it might make that person very antagonistic towards Islam. So I think it's very important for the common Muslims in Europe or America who've come from other lands to realize they have a responsibility, and that's a trust. And that conveying that trust is predicated on justice in the law and the movement, that God has commanded you to convey the trust to his righteous possessors. So there's a trust that Muslims in Holland have, who, despite you're very compassionate and balanced understanding, but I'm sure you'll admit a lot of the drug dealers in Holland are Muslim. A lot of the people filling up the bridges are Muslims. A lot of the people cheating on their taxes and finding ways to milk the system for money through welfare or other ways, means that shouldn't justify be theirs, are Muslims. And not everyone is as enlightened or fortunate as you to live in Oman and see Muslims from another angle. So Muslims have a responsibility to represent this religion and to convey this trust in a way that lessens the tension and takes away from the likes of this politician. What's his name again?
Pierre Bilbers.
Yeah, Bilbers. He's very popular, well-known in the West in terms of his kind of real fascist anti-Islamic attitude and composition. But propaganda only needs half truth to become believable. And it's the responsibility of every Muslim to do his or her best to remove that basis so that it can be seen as a lie, as a baseless lie. So, and then people like yourself, this is the responsibility to try to learn so that the judgment that they make is a just judgment in terms of, let me examine Muslims. Well, maybe there's some Muslims here who fit this stereotype, but is that the nature of the community overall? And so there's a need for justice and fairness and education on the one hand, and there's a need for for realizing the great responsibility and the great trust that Muslims hold on the other hand. And if the two can work together and encourage each other, then you can have a livable situation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In terms of the second, the first question, which is about apostasy, I think the Islam, like all the pre-modern religions, has apostasy laws. That aspect of the Sharia has been long gone, and is like other religions. Muslims, with the exception of Saudi Arabia, and I believe Iran has a moratorium right now, but they were applying, and there's been arguments to apply it in Afghanistan. There are still apostasy laws that are on the books. If you look at the early period of Islam, and there's arguments from Baha Jabir Alwani, actually a great Usuli scholar that I think is well known in Oman, wrote a book about arguing that the apostasy laws are really treasonous laws and should be seen as that. And that's one argument. There's no doubt if you look at the history of Islam, it was very rare that apostasy laws were ever applied. I'll give you one good example. Abu Anad Ma'arri, who is a very well-known poet and a very famous anti-Muslim writer. I mean, he really didn't like Islam. He lived to the ripe old age of almost 90 in Aleppo under Muslims. Now, I think the Arabs probably left him because he was such a good poet, and they figured, you know, even though he has Zendaka, anybody that can write poetry like that should be left alone. That's possible. But he's noted for many, many things. One of them, he talked about the Quran, the injunction about cutting off the hand of the thief, and he said, يَدٌ بِخَمْسِ مَئِينَ عَسْجِدٍ وُدِيَتْ مَا بَالُهَا قُطِعَتْ فِي رُبْعِ دِنَارِ. You know, a hand that you have to pay 500 dinars if you cut somebody else's hand off by accident. He said, what's up with cutting it off for a quarter of a dinar? And so Qadi Abdul Wahhab, the famous Maliki scholar from Iraq, said, عِزُّ الْأَمَانَةِ أَغْلَاهَا وَأَرْخَصَهَا ذُلُّ الْخِيَانَةِ فَفْهَمْ حِكْمَةَ الْبَارِي. The dignity of trustworthiness of that hand made it a valuable hand. But when it became a treacherous hand, it lost its value. My point about that is that that bait is kufr by Muslim scholars. I mean, and yet he was writing those lines in Aleppo, in a place that was ruled by Muslims. Many examples, if you look in the history of Islam, very rarely were apostasy laws applied. I'll give you another example. In Qurtuba, there's a famous, the martyrs of Qurtuba, that some Christians might know this story. There was a group of Christians who were so troubled by the fact that so many Christians in Spain were becoming Muslim, they started going into the masjids and cursing the Prophet ﷺ publicly so that the Muslims would turn on them. They actually wanted martyrdom so that they could revive the Christian spirit in Spain. The caliph actually ordered these people to be like, he didn't want it to happen. He was so bothered by it because one, he understood what their strategy was, but two, because he just didn't want that to be taking place. And so there's a whole interesting history of what was going on then. I would argue that in the West, we are in a post-Christian period. It's very difficult for Western people to understand when religion is central to your life and your experience, how important that is. And religion, one of the most powerful claims of Abrahamic religions is this world is finite, it's only a very short period, but the next world is infinite. And when you're looking at the finite world in relation to the infinite world has far more relevance to anybody who takes religion seriously. And so when somebody leaves the religion, it's an incredible calamity. Anybody that takes Christianity serious understands this at all, because they're putting the soul into perdition. In Holland, the Dutch people are in a very post-Christian environment. Very few Dutch people, even though they were once very, very, they've always had a history of tolerance until very recently with the Islamic thing. I mean, well, maybe not always, but they're noted for their tolerance. And I think they still are a tolerant people. They've tolerated heroin addiction and prostitution, a lot of other things that aren't so positive, but they are a tolerant people. And but religion is not taken seriously. And that's why it's very hard for a lot of Europeans to relate to the seriousness by which Muslims take their faith. And so if somebody leaves the faith in the family, it's as if they died. I have a Jewish friend who converted to Islam that Imam Zaid knows very well. Mustafa Chetnev. He's from New Mexico, and he lives there. He's a very brilliant man who embraced Islam. His parents, who were Orthodox Jews, had a funeral after he converted to Islam. They literally buried the coffin and told everybody that their son had died. Because to them it was as if he had died. He told me though that his mother used to send cookies at Hanukkah time. See, mothers can't, you know, the famous story of the Christians tell about Jesus not letting all the people that didn't believe in him into paradise, and then when he went into the garden he found all the people he had kicked out, and he said, what was going on? And it was, they said it was Mary, she was letting them in the back door, because women have more compassion, you know. So that was the, you know, that was the you know, the idea of giving a funeral was as if they had died. And I think for a lot of Muslims that is a real, it's a great calamity and tragedy. But in terms of ridda, apostasy laws, we tell people, I know people in America whose children have left Islam. It happens. I encourage people to maintain their relationships with them, because one, it's a very confusing time we're living in. The Prophet ﷺ said, يُصْبِحُ الْحَلِيمُ حَيْرَانَ, that even intelligent people will become confused towards the end of time. And we know also that the atheists win in the end, because the Prophet said that the end of time won't come until there's no one left calling on God in the world. So Dawkins wins in this world. And that's, we believe that. So, you know, apostasy is, you know, it's one of the pre-modern rulings that is definitely in Islam. Abu Hanifa did not consider women, if a woman apostated, there was no capital offense for a woman in the Hanafi madhab, because he did not, one, the hadith من بدل دينه فاقتلوه was ahad, it's ahad hadith, whereas the hadith prohibiting killing women and children is mutawatir. It's a factual hadith that nobody can deny. The Prophet said, do not naha Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam an qatil al-nisa'i wal-awlad. It's a mutawatir hadith. And so even in the Maliki madhab, it's prohibited to kill women. But if they fight you, you can kill them. But in the Maliki books, they say, if on the battlefield a woman comes towards you, you should avoid her and try to get away from her so that you don't have to kill her, because the prohibition was so strong about protecting women and children. Imam al-Nakhai did not believe in capital offense for apostasy. So there are ulama from the Salaf period that were from the students of the Sahaba that did not confer with that. He preferred ta'zir or habs, some type of discipline that would get them back into the deen. So, but I know that there are many secular people in the Muslim world that don't really believe in Islam, but the idea of openly declaring that is still not done in most countries, although there are open secularists in many Muslim countries today. There are Ba'athists and people that don't believe in Islam. And I mean, in the end, I think that freedom of conscience is something that the Prophet ﷺ honored, and he was certainly very aware of persecution. And we read that verse in the Quran that الْفِتْنَةُ أَكْبَرُ مِنَ الْقَتْرِ الْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْقَتْرِ. Persecution is worse than killing. You know, the Quran very clearly states you can't make people believe. You know, أَوَأَنْتَ تُكْرِهُ النَّاسَ أَنْ يَكُونُوا مُؤْمِنِينَ. Do you think you can force people into being believers? You can't. It only creates hypocrites. So,
good evening. Thank you very much for the lecture. I had a question. Well, Jesus said, turn the other cheek. And Mahatma Gandhi, who inspired himself who took his values from Hinduism, said, an eye for an eye makes the whole blind. How do you match this with Islam, which says that you should defend yourself? And, where's the matching bit in the puzzle? Thank you very much.
What's that? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that Islam doesn't advocate a system of ideal ethics. It advocates a system of practical ethics. So when you say turn the other cheek, that's ideal. But it's not practical for most human beings, because there's a fundamental instinct, and some say the most primal instinct in a human being is self-preservation. The top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs is security. So, as a result, when you have an ideal that's so lofty that it becomes almost impossible for most people to attain it, no one observes it. And as a result, even though Jesus said, turn the other cheek, as Sheikh Hamza mentioned last night, I only say this by way of making a point, not to begin the one religion on the other. Christian societies have by far and away been the most violent societies in history. Whereas when an ideal is practical, don't aggress, but if you transgress against, defend yourself, then this is something that people have an easier time adhering to, so it provides a check on their behavior because it's within the realms of feasibility for the average person, whereas where an ideal is so often is beyond the realms of the average person, then that ideal becomes abandoned, and then there's no practical check on people's actions. So that's how we respond to that. And I think that this is something that's not universal Torah Christians, but if you look at the sexual scandals that are befalling some members of the Catholic Church, a lot of that goes to the impracticality of celibacy. Because human beings have basic fundamental sexual rights from the animal part of our nature. So when you say there's no